I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 hello.
Hello, hello, hello,
to
hello.
The podcast.
Hello.
I'm Gary Bain, and this week...
Hang on.
This week...
Hang on, Gary.
I heard a strange voice.
That's not strange.
Depth of time, hiding in the background.
We've got a real treat this week, Pete.
What is it?
I'm here with the lovely Peter Hart, but we're joined by the even lovelier Dave O'Mara, who doesn't like to be called David.
He doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
Now, one thing that I think we've got to start with is that, of course, David is a Dave, sorry.
Yeah, I knew you'd do that.
He's a prominent, well-known historian. But the thing that, as I gave, you won't be able to look at him, punters, on the internet, but we could see pictures of him. And actually got a lot of hair, Gary.
Yeah, but it is a wig. It's definitely a wig. Oh, he's tugging it now. Oh, it's come off.
How embarrassing.
Tugging, I don't like to be tug off and come off on camera usually.
Anyway, oh, we so all like
it. Well, it's on the audio.
Now, just for those that don't know, Dave has been charged with writing the Pen and Sword series of Battleground Somme books dealing with the French contribution to the 1916 battles. And he may be better known to readers from his internet presence under the name of Croonart.
Why Croonart, Dave?
You don't want to know.
Really?
Seriously, you don't want
to know. Seriously, I do want to know now, but all right. So there's a dark and mysterious secret in his past. Now,
well, actually, I will tell you. It's the clean version of it is the fact that I was a family friend of André Beckart many, many years ago. And basically, he used to babysit for me while my parents went shopping when I was a little kid.
Right. That makes no sense whatsoever to me.
So now, that's not... Well, he used to run the Croonart Wad Museum.
All right. Now, it does make
many,
sense.
Many, many years ago.
And it sort of takes you back to your childhood experiences under his...
I was needing a name and I wanted one which was different, which people could find awkward to spell, etc. So...
Like Dave.
I don't get bombarded with spam.
Dave. Now, the book that we're centering on is a very good book. I remember reviewing it, reading it and reviewing it. And that was the Somme 1916 touring the French sector, Battleground Somme. And that was under David O'Mara. Very popular.
Yes, that's my official Sunday name.
Now, what we're going to do is talk through the French on the Somme. This is an outline discussion, isn't it, Gary? Because we know bugger all about it. And that is going to form part of the discussion, Dave, in the fact that British don't seem to care or acknowledge the enormous role of the French on the Somme. So that's one thing we're going to be doing. So where should we start? One thing I'd like your opinions, and like in the book, it starts. Can you give us an idea of the state of the French army in 1916? Well, 1914, then 1916.
Obviously, we had the catastrophic defeat of 1871. And then the following 10 years was full of political and material, basically arguments between top brass. There was also a lot of advances in technology at the time. I mean, the French were trying to get in, push themselves into the 20th century before everybody else. We had the worry of the rise of the German Empire. I don't think they really looked toward Britain as much as, apart from the Navy, as much of a threat. But Germany was definitely there on in the back of the mind all the time. So they were pushing forward with the smokeless powder for the ammunition and the rifles, etc. But as soon as that came out, other nations started doing the same thing, so it's obsolete. Uniforms and things, they try to push forward with different types of colour schemes, etc. There was even a version of field grey that they were experimenting with by the turn of the 20th century. But the French general public didn't really want to play. They said that the Red Trousers, for example, was part of France. The government ministers who could have been pushing the changes through just weren't interested because they didn't want to go against public opinion.
Now, one thing they did get ahead on was with the artillery. Well, I'm not sure it's ahead, but very famously, they did develop a particularly good field gun.
The quick firing 75. Yeah, that was one of the aspects that they were working on. It was one of their mainstay lighter field weaponry all the way through to the Second World War. So it was very, very advanced when that came out at the end of the 19th century. So was that they were working on machine guns, grenades. Grenades was another one of the aspects that they worked on. I mean, the French army was the only one to start the First World War with a full range of grenades, even chemical grenades.
Blimey, I didn't know that.
They were very much a continental army, weren't they, Dave? And they operated a system of conscription, didn't they?
Yes, they sort of copied that off the Germans, who'd adapted that before the Franco-German War of 1870.
Can you give us an outline of it, you know?
Yeah, on the second half of the Franco-German War, where we're talking after Sedan up to the end of the fighting, they were one of the first to conscript a complete citizen army, for want of a better word, where they had general conscription and they were called up into the mobile units and quickly trained, thrown into battle. But that was continued from 1872 when they did when they introduced national conscription across the board. At first, it started off, it was on a ballot system, but then there were several changes before the First World War started. The last of them being, if memory recalls correctly, about 1913. And they were called up at the age of 20, but they're usually about 21 years old when they went in. They'd have so many years. It starts off with 5 years and it eventually dropped down to 3 years as regular service, then 10 years in the reserves, 14 in various territorials, then dropping into the territorial reserves. So there was France was a very, very, by 1914, France had a hell of a lot of people who had military service. They'd also seen a lot of action, especially in the colonial wars over in North Africa and even in the Far East by that particular point. So there's a lot of experience, and practically every male under the age of, say, 45 knew how to handle the current weaponry, because the mainstay French rifle at the time, the Lebel Model 1886, had come out since 1886. So anybody who'd been in since that particular year knew how to fire the latest weapon that the French military was issued with.
Now,
same with the artillery. They had the same guns. They had the same weapons for decades.
Now, when the war started, there's the Battle of the Frontiers. Now, we did a whole podcast on this.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
But the only thing we can really want to say, other than to invite people to listen to that, is that the casualties were particularly awful. I think it was August 22nd, 27,000 dead, which means an awful lot of wounded as well. What state was the French army in, if you like, by 1916? Because it had shrunk, because in one sense, it ended up being 4,200,000. But then it sort of shrinks back with casualties and the return of key industrial agricultural workers. And it ends up at about 2.5 million or 2,235,000. Now, how has it responded to the challenges of 1914 and 15?
Well, one of the first things they did by the end of 1914 was to introduce the conscription to younger age classes. For example, the class of 1914 wasn't due to actually be incorporated into the army till approximately August, September of 1915. But they were called up in December 1914. By January 1915, the class of 1915, not due to be called up till 1916, was already in training, etc. So by the time the Battle of the Somme started, they were actually calling up the class of 1917. So you're talking 18-year-olds being called in. The very, very first of the class of 1917 was just arriving at the front. But the previous class had already had a year's experience, and the ones who were arriving on the at the front on the Somme had already seen at the least they'd seen battle experience at a place like Verdun.
And they weren't in the red and blue anymore, were they? Well, they were in light blue, weren't they?
Well, the well, in 1916, yeah. By that point, they changed to the light blue, later known as horizon blue, but. By the end of 1914, but not the end of 1914, we're talking October 1914, supplies of the uniforms were getting low. Apart from anything, you've got masses and masses of reservists being recalled. Yes, they've got their own uniform, but looking at it another way, they've been civilians for a while. Some of them put the weight on and they can't fit in them uniforms anymore. So them uniforms get passed on to somebody else. So they need some new uniforms. They don't have enough of the red. Some of the dye came from Germany. They're not going to get the dye from Germany. So the red trousers quite often were replaced by dark blue. Leather gaiters replaced by Alpine style high leg putties, like the British were worn, like the British wore up to the knees. Basically, I always call the winter of 1914, 1915 the French ersatz winter. Because the amount of equipment that they had, which they had to make do with, they had canvas ammunition pouches instead of leather ammunition pouches. We had a full range of tunics and greatcoats. Anything from the issued iron blue, all the way to what they call English grey, which was supplied from England. I think it was blanket material from England. So you got a full range of those. I mean. Blaise Cendrars in The Severed Hand, he mentions somebody wearing black trousers. He says they were priests' trousers acquired from some seminary school. He says so they were at the front line wearing priests' black trousers.
So they looked a mess overall. Okay, but they'd learnt a lot in 15, hadn't they? I mean, 15 is one of the worst years for the French. How had they come out of 15? What state were they in? I mean, because they'd had some terrible battles in Champagne and Arras and Artois, yeah. I always forget its name, French name. and there's a great book, the name of which I always forget and have forgotten again, which you reminded me of last time, but I can see from your blank expression you forgot.
I forgot it as well, I'm trying to think of it.
Gary, what was it, mate? how would you describe the French army as it emerged from the trials of 1915? Again, we can't go into that, but what state was it in?
It was a new army. Compared with the army that went into 1915, it was a new army. They'd adapted the tactics mainly through Artois, but they tested them out in Champagne. New tactics. They were using, instead of extended order, advancing straight into the machine guns, the classic First World War battle in most people's minds. They were using modern tactics, fire and manoeuvre tactics, dash, down, crawl, observe sites, fire, etc. Moving around in small, using small formation tactics where they've got only groups of six. They'd adapted the versions of light machine guns. They'd taken on foreign weaponry when they couldn't use their own, etc. So, and like I said, the grenadiers, they just worked on the grenades. They'd worked on gas shells, etc. They were very, very, they were very advanced.
What about the use of heavy artillery? Because we always think about the French. What about French artillery? The heavy artillery had moved on, hadn't it? There was a lot more use of heavy artillery.
There was a hell of a lot of use of heavy artillery. I mean, you talk about the Second Battle of Artois is the highest use of the biggest bombardment that the world had ever seen up to that particular point. They just didn't seem to suffer from any shell shortages that the British had the problem with during during the period. They were using, well, artillery tactics had advanced as well. Instead of just doing blanket bombardments all over the place, they developed the creeping barrage where the infantry would advance behind it.
No, Dave, the Canadians developed the creeping barrage. And
they invented it 2 years after the French used it, didn't they? Yeah,
that's right. They invented the... Please don't. I mean, that's just so disrespectful to the Canadians.
Sorry, they didn't call it creeping barrage. I'll let the Canadians have the creeping barrage term.
They called it le barrage creepy.
Creepy, yeah. Can I just say, Dave, now that I'm getting a word in, the popular British view is that the Brits took over a quiet sector in the Somme. But actually, there was French campaigns in that area, weren't there?
I mean, even in 1870.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 1870, you've got three major battles, all related to the same outcome. It was an attempt to relieve Paris. But you got Ferdinand's Army du Nord going against the German First Army, who'd already fought at Villers-Bretonneux, Amiens, the Roman road going towards Peronne. Then you've got the fighting up at Bapaume as Ferdinand tries to break down towards Peronne to actually relieve the siege of Peronne, which has been ongoing since the end of December. So you've got the Battle of Bapaume in January 1871, which is actually a French victory, which they can't push because there's so many Germans in the area that they don't advance even further. So Peronne eventually capitulates. The Somme River crossings haven't been captured. The Army du Nord can't move down on the bit of a forlorn hope, but there was always a hope there that they would be able to get across the river and down to Paris, but they didn't. So they moved on to safe quarters, quarters in Saint-Quentin. But they were pursued all the way by the First Army. Massive battle at Saint-Quentin. The Army du Nord is totally destroyed. And retreat up to the fortresses around Lille, where, which never usually gets a mention, they actually regroup. And within three, four weeks later, they're the same size as they were before Peronne, but they never get called into action again. So that's the fighting of 1877.
Well, now, what about 1870, 1871? In 1914, there's the Race to the Sea battle sort of thing, isn't there, or whatever? There's a lot of battles in the area. Just, again, sketch out 14 and 15 for us, just so that we know.
You've got the advances of August 1914, where the Germans are moving from the area of Cambrai towards, heading towards Paris. But you've got territorial divisions up near Cambrai delaying them slightly. You got the 61st and 62nd, which at the time were reserve divisions. They moved down from Arras and accidentally crossed into the German advance on the 28th of August up near Moisselin and Bapaume. There's a massive battle there, thousands of casualties. In fact, there's a cemetery up there called the Cimetière de Charentes, which they were buried in, a lot of the victims were actually casualties, not victims. Casualties were buried in a sunken road, which they had to hide from the German machine gun fire.
And now, that's not the end of it, though, is it? And just
this is just the very beginning. This is August. But then, obviously, the Germans are carrying on the advance. They get so far, you've got the Battle of Marne, blah, blah, blah. They get pushed all the way back. They get pushed beyond the Somme and then advance again. So September 1914, you've got the second Bombshire fighting in the area. Same area, you've got what they call the Battle of Picardy, the Battle of Albert, the first Battle of Albert, really. As you say, it's the Race to Sea, so obviously the fighting actually starts south of the river. They're moving further and further up. They're going into across the river. There's fighting around Maricourt, La Boisselle. It doesn't quite reach as far as the River Anc yet, but the fighting through September, Le Transloy, up towards Bapaume again. I mean, there's a ossuary at Le Translay, which has something like 7,000, 8,000 bodies buried in it from just 2 days' action, one in August and one in September. So it shows the scale of the fighting that was up there. Sailor, Sailor, Sail, Roncor, those areas were absolute killing zones in 1914. Then the advance goes so far, goes across. You've got a lot back fighting near Longeval, Montauban, Maricourt. The line tends to stabilise around that area a little until the following month, October, when the Prussian Guard arrive further up north. Then you've got the First Battle of Ebertin, where they actually push across the Ancre and get towards Serre. By the end of it, you've got the line as it would roughly be in 1916. There's no, further actions November 1914, December the 17th, 1914, when it was suddenly decided that the French are going to launch a full-out offensive, basically from Beaumont-Hamel all the way down to the River Somme, which is absolutely a disastrous result. For like up to Christmas Eve, constant fighting and just no man's land between Thiepval and Maricourt was absolutely littered with dead bodies. It's even shown on German drawings, trench sketches and things like that actually show French bodies in no man's land as part of a feature of the land to operate around.
Now, that's quite extraordinary. The places that you're naming there resonate with the British. You mentioned Serre, you mentioned Thiepval, and yet, you know, largely the British had no idea that there was any French activity in those areas.
Well, the first time I ever went to the Somme, just kicking around in the fields, always frank French bullets. French bullets up in a ditch next to the Thiepval Memorial. I found more French bullets than I found British bullets. And I thought, why? I'm going back 30-odd years here. This is one of the reasons why I end up eventually writing these books. Because I wanted to answer that question for myself. Why? There's nowhere to give me that answer. So I had to find out for myself.
Now, just to sum up 15, the fighting doesn't stop in 14. It goes on into 15. There's a local French offensive at Serre in June 15. There's mine warfare all over the place, the glory hole. And yet when the British take over, we tend to say it's a quiet sector, don't we?
Yeah, I wouldn't have said it was a quiet sector if I got shoved there, would you? Well, no, you've got Redan Ridge. Redan Ridge was riddled with mine craters. I mean, there's some disastrous ones. I think the French blew themselves up on the Redan Ridge, and so did the Germans. Then, like you said, you got down towards La Boisselle, where they were blowing each other up at the ranges of, 200 yards. Then further, just slightly further down in front of Fricourt. Then down near Montauban, more mines down there. Then you go south of the river, you got even more. You got Faye, you've got Dompierre. It's just mine warfare all the way up. 1915 was the real underground war up that area, apart from the Second Battle of Ebertin up at Serre, and obviously Ebertin.
And the British take over in late 1915?
July 1915, yeah. July the 31st.
Do they take over the whole Somme front, or is that just a British perspective? They don't.
They just take over part of the northern section from the area in front of Goncourt down to... they actually take it over down to the River Somme. And
slightly, bit.
Yeah, they pull back slightly later, but they take it down to the River Somme down at Fargney Mill, because there's plenty of stories of soldiers swimming in the river down that area, swimming towards the German lines. That area was a live and let live area, because I think the Germans liked doing the same, so that nobody was shooting at anybody down in that area. The British actually also took over the area down further, down to the Roman road between Amiens and Peronne. They took over that area for a very, very short period of time at the end of 1915.
But then went back.
The two divisions that were down there ended up getting moved over to Salonika. So I'm not 100% certain the reason why they took over that area, but...
I didn't know about that. I think the French just
wanted a little break.
And we'll be able to put some maps up, won't we, Pete, for the podcast?
Thank you, Gary. Yes. when you've told me, when I've forgotten.
Yeah.
Gary's in charge of the memory. You mentioned something that intrigued me there, and it's live and let live. Now, that is often seen as a French thing. briefly just explain to me and Gary, who are often puzzled, what Live and Let Live is. It's very, it's a James Bond film, is it? No, that's
it's just a case of you've got two enemies in the same place who both had bad experiences in the past. They don't want to kill each other anymore. So if you're peaceful with them, they'll be peaceful with you, and everybody just gets on with life.
Gary's favourite example of that is where, Gary? Gallipoli? What was your favourite thing there?
I have no idea.
The French, the well that was shared.
Oh, the well, sorry, yes. No, in the French sector at Gallipoli. But again, if you went there at a different time of day, they would shoot at you. So there were rules around it.
Yeah, they had ruled. That's entirely right. I knew I could jog your little memory there.
I was miles away.
Now, we're not. I thought I heard eating, so I wondered whether you were having your breakfast. we're not going to go through how the British and French came to launch the thing, but it was meant to be the British as the junior partners, then it became the British as the senior partners, although still always the French are equals, if not superior, really, in reality. We're going to ignore all the sort of strategic side, but let's look at the success of the French assault on the 1st of July, which... that they employed something like 732 heavy guns, same number of field artillery, 1,100 trench mortars, 8 million high-quality shells. And what's the difference between a British shell and a French shell, Gary? This is a bit of a test for you. In 1960, which one's that?
The French one.
It's true, though, isn't it, Dave? The French shells went bang.
Well, yeah, they were higher quality.
Because the and this is worth remembering because it makes the barrage more effective. Now we're going to I think we'll have a little test of what you've told us. So we're going to get if you could invigilate for us, Dave. We're going to look at why the French attacks north and south of the Somme River on 7:30 on 1st July were a success. Now I'll bagsy the easy one, and you see what you think, Dave. The use of heavy artillery to destroy the German deep dugouts. They had more heavy artillery and they were better targeted to actually take out the deep dugouts that the British artillery failed to do. Would that be correct?
That is correct, yes.
I got it from your books.
Wasn't going to say no then, was I? Yeah, they had massive railway guns, the super heavies, way back. There were masses of artillery, heavy artillery.
So heavy artillery. Gary, what would you like?
I say super heavy artillery.
Yeah, which we did a pod. We remember we did Cleve. Yeah, but yeah. That was 1917, no, 1918. British just slow off the mark. Go on, Gary, you think of what you've thought of.
Well, they also concentrated the bombardment on the German first lines and devastated the German defences.
Yes. Yeah.
As opposed to the British, who spread it across two systems. Two systems, yeah. Not two lines.
Not two lines. It was two trench systems, yeah.
They also weren't concentrating on just trying to destroy wire. They were destroying the actual positions behind the wire with full intention of once they've got those positions, they'll move on to the next positions, as will the artillery.
Now, can I put forward the one we've talked about already? Le barrage du creep.
The infantry go over while it's still being hit. The infantry move into that position as at a priorly set time. The artillery moves on to the next position, as does the infantry. Behind the infantry, they've got what they call the nettoyers, the cleaners.
Well, the next one, Dave, you've mentioned this earlier, that they used lightly equipped troops who advanced in small groups.
You said taking six.
Taking all advantage of any cover or rush defences, and then they followed that up by heavily equipped mopping up teams, which I assume is the cleaners you're referring to.
Yes,
far advanced from the British. It's two completely different approaches.
We're talking stormtrooper tactics that a lot of the British histories make a massive deal about, with the Germans using it. Well, the French were using it end of 1915 into 1916. It was a common attacking tactic used by the French.
That is a brilliant point. And to back that up, they concentrated on tactically significant objectives rather than making a general advance along a line like the British did. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah. Prior to the attack, they chose what the objectives were going to be. Usually the reasonably attainable objectives. They'll attack those And then they'll concentrate on the next objective. Instead of trying to think, oh, we'll take this massive area of land, we'll take this little bit of land. Once we've captured that, we'll move on to the next bit. The overall picture, yeah, it'd be great if we managed to get the big bit, but if we only get the little bit, it's still a success.
That sounds a bit like bite and hold.
Yeah, but there's not the hold. It's the thought of moving on constantly. All it's right. The bite and bite again. But bite, and if you can't bite again, you stay.
bit like you with a chocolate eclair, Gary.
And if you can't bite again, you kick them in their goolies.
Now, I've got a quote. We're not doing quotes this time, but this quote is to sum up the success of the French on the first day, because they attain all their objectives, I think, according to one David.
In some cases, Omar. They exceed them.
No, I said they didn't.
Oh, God, damn.
There's two areas. 98% successful. There's two areas that they actually don't succeed.
I'm afraid that's good enough for me. we can't go into detail, but so let's just take it as 98% successful. But this quote is from Joseph Foy of 265th Infantry Regiment. Regiment d'Infantry?
Yeah. Just call them a regiment. It's easier.
It is a lot.
I can read French, but my spoken French isn't brilliant.
Baird. Vaton coulé.
My spoken English ain't that great.
This is what Foy says. Our artillery preparation was wonderful. It completely destroyed the German defences and our assault waves managed to cross the lines without much resistance. Only an enemy counter barrage claimed a few victims. As soon as the first wave had set off, we advanced over the heavily cratered ground, ready to help out those in front. The enemy continued to send over a heavy barrage, so we dug in when we reached the outskirts of Fay to avoid taking too many casualties. The shells fell very close by, but we were right at the bottom of our trench and they didn't touch us. So that just gives you an idea of the success. I've no idea where Fay is, but I'm sure it's a village somewhere.
South of the river. His regiment actually suffered from 37 dead and 198 wounded that day, but that's being nerdy, isn't it?
You nerdy bastard!
Or was it 199.
Gary, bad Gary. Now, so it was a great success. What do you put it down to? Artillery and infantry tactics?
I'd say both artillery, yeah, in a combination, yeah. Mainly artillery, I'd say, because the two places where they failed are the two places where the artillery was actually not up to scratch.
Well, the British failed because their artillery wasn't good enough, except in the south, where they were greatly helped by the French.
And right at the join between the British and the French is one of the places where the French failed.
And British. Now, so overall, the French were a success. The British were a relative failure, definitely, even in the south then.
Well, they were more successful in the south, you could say, the British.
More successful than the British in the north. Yeah,
what I'm talking about the French failure in that area, we're talking 100 yards of a wood. They fell short by 100, 200 yards in the top corner of a wood near Marico. That's it. But it caused them to have a lot of issues and severe fighting for about a week afterwards. A lot of skirmishing in that area.
Now, we haven't got too much time, so I'll just sum up a few things that I noticed from your book. The first fortnight seems to be... north of the river, hampered by the British failure, relative failure, yes. And that consolidation is their main focus north of the river while they wait for the British to sort themselves out, I presume.
Yes.
But there were attacks towards Hem. Look at your maps, boys and girls, if I remember to put them up. From 5th of July to clear the German artillery threat from the Hem Plateau. So that's an example of a tactical objective that is triggering attacks. But it also triggers vicious fighting round the Hem Plateau, round Hem. Do you want to make any comments on that?
Well, the Hem Plateau was...
That's north of the river, isn't it?
Yes, just north of the river.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, but south of the river, they're advancing too fast. They're advancing too fast. So the Hem Plateau was a threat to the advance on the south. So they had to eradicate that threat as soon as possible because the Flaucourt Plateau was very, very exposed. It's exposed from the artillery on the Hem Plateau. It's under observation from La Maisonette, near just south of Peron, and also Mont-Saint-Quentin, which was artillery positions and artillery observation. So the advance south of the river was very, very much under threat until the Hem Plateau could be eradicated.
Now, generally, one thing I got very clearly from your book is that south of the river, one of the biggest problems is geographical. In that that stupid river bends round.
The elbow, so it's,
yeah. Yeah, the elbow.
Yeah.
which means that the French are advanced. They're advancing very fast, but they're also advancing with the Somme on their left and suddenly the Somme right in front of them and the hills of Peronne in front of them as well. Gradually, the progress dies to an end, doesn't it? And do you want to talk about the fighting at villages like, if you'd be ready to talk on the high summer part, we've got to sort this out because I'm doing all the talking there from me too. So you get ready to do the high summer. But can you, Dave, tell us a bit about Biache and La Maisonnette? Because there seems to be appalling fighting around those places. Well, we British have never heard of them.
La Maisonnette was one of the main targets immediately south because, like I've just mentioned earlier, the artillery observation that you could see everywhere from it. So that was one of the targets that they had to eradicate as soon as possible, which accounts for the rapid advance in the south. By the 2nd of July, the south of the river, by the 2nd of July, the aerial observation was saying that there were no Germans in sight. They'd gone. But they're saying, why didn't they push forward even faster? I said, because they couldn't because of the Hem Plateau up in the north. So they had to advance a bit more cautiously. Cautiously meaning like major advances every 4 days or so. You push forwards towards, for example, Berlin-Santerre, which is famous for Alan Seeger. Hellishly fighting there with the Regiment de Marche, the Legion of Tranger, the Foreign Legion. On the 4th of July, I think about eight Americans. We've got Alan Seeger, who's the famous one who died there.
Why is he famous? Sorry.
He's a well-known writer and poet. I mean, I don't really do for poets, but there's one poem that he likes, that he wrote that I like. But somebody else who died with him who should be equally famous was a fellow called Siegfried Narwitz, who... another American, another New Yorker, who was a professor of philosophy, who was living in Paris at the time that the war broke out. And he was killed alongside Seeger. And he's probably buried in the same place at Lyon French Cemetery.
Fine French name, Siegfried.
Siegfried, yeah. Siegfried Narwitz, yeah. that fighting there absolutely fascinates me. The first wave gave him... old-fashioned style battle, went across in extended order, cut down in swathes in the corn, didn't break through. Second wave went through using the proper tactics, small unit tactics, and actually got through, grenaded the hell out of the German front line, and then managed to break through. Prisoners taken in the first line from the first assault, heard the commotion going on short behind them, most of them carrying Algerian daggers. So they decided to shank the guards. That's a sh, not a W, by the way. So they shanked the guards, broke free. So the front lines were being attacked from both sides. And then they managed to get through. You move on to...
I'll have to look that word up.
Which one?
Shank. Yeah, I know the other one.
Go to prison and find that one out. Both of them, probably. Mind you, I think the other one had gotten free from the guards as well, if they'd pushed that one. But... carry on moving on to fighting around Biache. Managed to push through there, but then the Germans launched a counterattack, shoved them back a bit, and there's hellish fighting over near the fort under Biache, which was a fortified area up near the river. Surrounded by machine guns to the north, they just couldn't get through it, couldn't eradicate it, but then eventually, with a little bit of deception, the French managed to capture it. Move on to what was it? La Maisonnette. I always want to call it Malmaison. similar story, though. Move on to the hill of Maisonnette. Big fortified farmhouse and a chateau. French managed to get through to it at first. Then they got pushed back. And throughout the rest of the battle, it changed hands several times. I think it changed hands about four times in one day. Both sides wanted it that much. Because the observation from the top meant that the French could look out over Peronne, over the river, across the flat plains across the other side, whereas the Germans could move. They could watch everybody. They could see every movement from there all across the Flocourt Plateau, all the way back to the old 1st of July front lines.
Now, one of the points that we make is that the battle isn't only about the 1st of July and the weeks following. And actually, the fighting in that area goes on for the rest of the campaign, doesn't it, Dave? And we move into high summer now. And Allied progress to the south of the battlefield, coupled with the British failure to the north, it's created a dangerous salient, doesn't it? And it meant that the French would have to attack east at this point, pushing out from Hardecourt Bois towards Guillemont and Maurepas. So tell us a bit about the attacks in the high summer.
They're not so successful, are they?
No, by this time we're hitting quite a few problems. I mean, the 30th of July was the worst day for the French on the Somme.
I see my notes helpfully put 20th of July.
Well, the first attack there was the 20th. That was a failure, but the worst one was
a little
bit later.
It's just a matter of judgment, not a mistake then.
So when you say the worst, Dave, on the 30th of July, do you mean in terms of the casualties suffered?
Casualties and complete and utter failure, yeah. There was a complete artillery. We're talking just off the Hem Plateau area again, still fighting for this area.
Why was it so bad? Was it just the Germans had moved up their reserves, or is it that the French had changed their tactics?
Artillery failure for some reason. Somebody high up cocked up. There was an artillery failure in the area. The French attacked over. The German artillery was still fully operational in the area, hitting them from Hem Wood, and just behind Hem Wood, and plastered no man's land as soon as they attacked. So, and the artillery hadn't softened up. They'd done the British tactic of trying to bombard the entire area, flooded it with gas, and basically just hit random areas without targeting specifics. So the French ended up attacking over into no man's land, got cut to pieces in no man's land. All communications were lost. The panic, soldiers trying to get back to their own lines. Nobody knew where anybody was. You can imagine the dust, the confusion, everything. The French are firing on the French. The Germans are bombarding the hell out of no man's land. Nobody can move. Yard for yard, French casualties in that area were actually worse than anywhere that the British suffered on the 1st of July. But we're only talking an area covering about 2 miles. So it never really gets recorded.
But they are grinding their way forward, aren't they?
Very, very slowly, yeah. Further up to the north, we're hitting woodlands. We're going through heavily defended woods. We're going attacking German second and third line systems. Third line wasn't completely developed at the time, but by the time they're reaching there, they put a hell of a lot of effort into it. So you're talking belts and belts of barbed wire, which can't be cleared by the shells. You've got stiffer German resistance. You've got German divisions that have been moved up from the Meuse, moved up from Verdun at this point, fighting in the north. Well,
it's just it's as bad as anything the British are facing, if not worse.
It is.
What do the Germans always do?
Counter-attack
all the time, yeah. Also, they're the ones who are defending these villages, which they've been fortifying for a long time. Mentioned in 1914, Celle, I think it's the bloodiest village on the entire Somme battlefield, because they ended up fighting house to house throughout there, and it took them 3 months to get through it. And that's one village.
Now, again, I've got to keep it going just because of time, but in autumn, September, the attacks just seem to just get worse and worse. They begin a series of attacks on the 3rd of September, and they north of the river, they have some success in the village. Is it La Forêt? This is typical. I wrote a book about the Somme. I don't know any of this. This is the indictment of British historians.
It's a little hamlet, is La Forêt, yeah.
Their progress is held up by British failures further north, isn't it? And then there's another huge attack on the 12th of September.
A lot of the French attacks...
More fighting, hard fighting.
A lot of the French attacks north of the river are actually in support of the British or just to keep it going. South of the river, bear in mind, by this point, we're talking 12th September, they've already hit that elbow in the river. They can't advance any further, apart from the 10th Army attack, which they launch on, is it 3rd of September? In a different angle, where they extend the battlefield further down. But north of the river, it's just stagnated. It's... one of the original aims of the battle was to kill as many Germans as possible. And that's how it's working. It's a battle of attrition. and it's wearing the Germans down. In fact, it's up north. It's the north, the area of Saint-Pierre-Vast, that the Germans came closest to actually breaking. If you read German reports, for example, in Jack Sheldon's books, it's mentioned that the Germans nearly broke on the Somme in that area. So that's one of the other reasons why they're pushing and pushing and pushing. They're doing what people say about Verdun in reverse. They're trying to bleed the German army wide.
Brilliant. Now, it goes on, 6th of October, they try a big attack, but bad weather, the weather breaks, doesn't it?
The weather was terrible, yeah.
And then I'm going to, in a sense, bring it to the end, in the sense of vicious, vicious fighting around, I can't pronounce it, Chong.
Chong. Yeah.
Or is that the northern way of it?
Sure. All right.
There's terrible fighting around that area, isn't it? And that it all goes on until the 17th of December. And I was like, when people talk about this as the British battle, when did we jack in?
Oh, Gary? Hang on. 18th of November, the Somme battle ends.
Yeah,
that's a well-known fact.
I know that fact, Gary. 18th. I'm just asking you to make sure it was 18th. But they carry on till the 17th of December. That's a month of extra fighting, particularly, I think, round Chon. But and it isn't, is it, what's Alex's book, 141 days?
Yeah.
This is
everything claims 141 days, yeah.
Well, it's not, it's 171.
Well, I always believe that a battle's finished when all the participants say that it's finished.
Yeah, well, usually.
It was an Anglo-French battle, which was originally going to be led by the French. So surely the battle ends when the French say it was. And Nivelle called the battle off on the 17th of December.
Nivelle had taken over. We haven't talked much about the French.
Foch had been sacked by this point. Well, now, 5 days earlier.
So it's your view that the French were fighting at an intense rate right the way through till the 17th of December. It's a murderous battle. The French suffered. Gary, how many casualties? You like casualties. I always forget them. I don't mean forget them. I mean forget the figures. Whoops.
Well, the French suffer over 202,000 casualties, of which more than 66,000 were dead. Now, if you compare that to the British are estimated to be 420,000 casualties with 125,000 dead. So the French are very, very much, you know, contributing to the Battle of the Somme. And let's not forget, at the same time, they're fighting at Verdun. You know, it's a massive contribution. And the French are suffering a daily average of 200 more dead per day in some area, more than they're suffering at Verdun. It's incredible.
You've also got to bear in mind, though, that that reflects the tactics as well, because as you were saying the French did a big commitment to the battle, but you've got to think about the amount of divisions that were involved in it. Figure was it... something like 50 divisions involved in the Battle of the Somme.
1, 2, 3 lots.
Yeah, I think it was about. I think in the Battle of the Somme was 50 or 51 divisions involved. The French committed 48 divisions, while at the same time, like Gary was just saying, committing 66 or 69 divisions to Verdun.
I think this is a great point that you two have collectively made. It's not big and clever to get more casualties. No. And actually, the French effort, I think you're saying, Dave, is equal. It's just that the British effort was more incompetent and therefore they suffered more casualties whilst carrying out the same level of operations.
Yeah.
It's not that they were doing more in some senses. They're doing about the same. It's just that their tactics were not as well developed. This is they're basically in the stage the French were in early 1915, I would argue.
Yeah, they were definitely good 12 months behind the French, tactically. The other thing to look at on the scale of the comparative scale between the two is that the French actually, by the end of the battle, were holding a longer line than the British were, just on the Somme. For square meterage, they actually took more land.
Well, I wanted to say, Gary, you wanted to make a point about the damage the French did to the Germans, because that's surely one way of analysing who's doing work. We're not disparaging the British, by the way. We're just saying they're at a different stage of development. That's what our point is. Gary, what did the French do?
Well, they certainly inflicted severe damage over the whole course of the battle, not just, you know, the early parts of the battle. So they captured over 41,000 German prisoners, 275 guns and mortars. Now, that's always an index of successful operations if you're capturing guns, and 535 machine guns.
Blimey. Now, what? So this is an enormous, it is an Anglo-French battle. Why don't we remember it as the British, Dave? Are we just stupid? Why don't we pay proper tribute to the French?
Dunkirk, 1940.
Is that so, it?
That's the fast answer, I think, because of the British attitude towards the French.
We've got 5 minutes. You think that the British don't think the French are any good after Dunkirk? The French think we deserted them at Dunkirk, by the way.
Yes, I know. And there were also, I've got reports of some of them wondering why they were getting off the boats at in England when they thought they were going to be just taken off and dropped further down the coast, continuing the fight. Yeah, I don't agree with that, by the way, but that's the attitude that I've seen quite a lot. The cheese-eating surrender monkeys, etc. type.
Well, that has to be stamped on that attitude. Now, I'd like to congratulate you personally, because over the internet and your books, you've done more than anyone almost that I could think of to stamp on that, which has been great. What do you think? My point would be that publishers they want books to be short. I know when I wrote my Somme book, I was told to keep it quiet about the Germans. They were in the battle as well. And the French, because they don't want the book to get too long. They don't want it complicated. They want an easy narrative drive. Would you say that I'm just a swine and a bastard not to have sort of ignored the publishers and done it? Or do you understand?
I understand completely, because I was actually a headhunter to write these books. These are books that I would have wanted to write several years ago, but I'd come across the same attitude. I didn't think I could. Then all of a sudden, Nigel Cave said to me, I want somebody to write these books. Will you do it? And I went, no. And my wife said, yes, you will.
Now, well, you're probably looking forward to getting back to the battlefields. Do you take tours or do you just go yourself? You must be looking forward to the chance to get back there.
I'm like a heroin addict who's gone cold turkey.
Is that like Gary with food? Don't mention cold turkey to Gary, he'd eat it. Now, I just want to finish up by saying thank you very much. I want to re-emphasise your book, because people should buy it. The one I know best, I know you've written at least two, is the Somme 1916, Touring the French Sector, which is in the Battleground Somme series. It's available on Amazon or any other source. It's under your posh name of David O'Mara. Have you got any others you want to mention that people should be seeking out and buying? You've got about
the one which I'm actually more proud about than that one is the second book, from Serre to the River Somme.
Oh, right.
The French on the Somme, from Serre to the River Somme, 1914 to June 1916, which covers the story from the beginning of the war to the, well, it actually ends on June the 30th, 1916.
So I think we might even come back to that in a year or so, because that sounds interesting. And I know I've got that book as well, because you sent it to me to review, and I don't think I did.
No, you didn't.
I trust there's no bitterness there, David. The first review was so favourable that I'd run out of praise words.
There's actually another two books to be done on the 1916 battle, which I'm doing similar idea to the first one, but more detail, one for the north of the river and one for the south of the river.
Sounds great. Sounds great.
They'll be about 2 years down the line yet.
Look forward to them.
Gary, any last words about your contact with David?
No, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I must admire a man who has the confidence to wear lime green headphones.
They're not mine. My son,
oh, we all say that. Oh, they're not mine.
No, not mine.
All right, it's been an absolute pleasure, David.
It has. Thank you.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?